I think yesterday I mentioned a book by a guy named John Smith. I haven't really picked up from anybody how he has responded to here in Australia. He is from Melbourne, the Melbourne area, is my understanding. And all I know about him is that he's done some videotapes, and I've seen a picture of him. He does not look like the typical cleric. That much I know. The last time I was in Australia, they promised that I would meet him. This time they didn't even raise the issue, so I'm not sure why. But he wrote this fascinating little book, and he begins one of his chapters with these words, and you may have heard them before. A kid came to me on the street, a switchblade packing kid from an inner Melbourne suburb, offering me a wee chink possibility. He said, "Okay, mate, tell me what's God like, and I'll talk to you." His response was a concession, and it was obvious that he didn't particularly want to talk. At the time, I was studying the Lord's Prayer in Bible college, so the answer came readily. In my terrible ignorance of his environment, I said, "Well, son, God is like your father." His eyes filled with hatred as he bitterly declared, "If he's anything like my bloody old man, you can stuff him up your jumper." That's very significant to Julie and me, because we finally found out what a jumper is. I knew he was sticking it up something, but I wasn't sure what. I figured it was something he wore. We've learned so much on this trip. I found out later, he said, that his sister had been raped by their father, a man who regularly beat up his wife and children after a few too many drinks. The angry kid walked away, and I was left in pieces, feeling stupid and angry and ignorant in my naive approach. And John Smith goes on to point out that here was a kid whose view of God was colored by the view he had in his own family. And he goes on to suggest that many of us have our views of life colored by our own experiences. Experiences in our families, but other kinds of experiences. And he goes on in this book about Australia to suggest that our views of life depend on not only the families where we grew up, not only the neighborhoods where we grew up, but the countries in which we grew up. And he goes on to talk about the fact that much of the history of Australia has a bearing on the way Australians think, on the perspectives Australians have, on their way of looking at things, and on their way at looking at problems and the difficulties in life. An interesting observation, and I certainly, as an outsider, cannot comment on some of John Smith's subsequent comments about Australian culture, but I certainly agree that we are products of our history. You and I are shaped by the cultures in which we have grown up. We're shaped by our families. We're shaped by our own personal histories and some of the traumas that we may have encountered or some of the good experiences that we may have had in the back. Smith goes on to say this: "Any nation to some extent is a reflection of the thinkers who go on before it. The intellectuals and the thinkers, those who struggle with the great questions in life, may not rule in the political sphere, but in the long run they do so by default. It's the people who struggle with the questions of life, the people who deal with the issues that we have to be concerned about, they ultimately have an impact, which I think has some real bearing on what we'll be talking about tonight when we look at some of these social issues that are so crucial right now. But even if we have been shaped by the past, as I think we have, even if we are products of our families and of our past experiences that have shaped our personalities, as we have, I don't think we're helpless victims of the past. My theology doesn't allow me to say that we are helpless victims of our past, and neither does my psychology. The past has affected us, but I think we can also have some influence on shaping where we go, coming out of our past, and what happens in the future. And that's the challenge I've got this afternoon. I probably should let you know that I find this probably the most exciting of all the topics that I've been given. And I'm enthusiastic about most of the topics on this list that I was given as I've gone through this series here. But how we go from here, where we go in the future, to me, I think is a significant topic, especially as we look at Christian counseling, where you live, where we work, what's going to happen to it in the days that are ahead. When we turned into this last decade, when the year 1990 appeared at home, we had a whole group of people came out with books, and articles, and speeches, and I'm sure a whole lot of sermons on what was going to happen as we went through these last 10 years of this decade and moved on into the new century. And there's a whole collection of books came out, and I started pulling some of these together and started reading them. Some of the books were very interesting. Somebody suggested, for example, in one of the books, that in the next century, that's only, 9 years from now, it is estimated that 22% of all people will work out of their homes, at least where we live. That's becoming more and more prevalent, because with fax machines and telephones and coffee machines and all that stuff at home, you don't have to go to work anymore. No need to face the traffic. We'll work out of our homes. For some of you, especially some of you who have husbands, to think that the husband might be around the house all the time may send you into sheer panic. But nevertheless, that may be happening. And a lot of people, go back to those housewives again, a lot of those women who are creative women, career-type women, have discovered they've got kids at home, it's not always easy to get out of the house, but they can very often work their careers and begin to continue to work on their careers even while they're home. That's a change. It's suggested by one writer that women will earn salaries comparable with those of men. And hasn't happened yet, but certainly should. The job switching will be more of the norm. We discover as we go through life in certain parts of the world, I'm not sure what happens here, but at home they estimate that people change jobs, 6 or 8 times, and most people change their actual line of work, their professions, at least 3 or 4 times. And this is going to be more common, because some of the work we're in now may shift. And I'm not doing now what I thought I was going to be doing even 20 years ago. I never thought I'd ever write a book. I certainly never thought I'd be speaking at conferences. I was going some other direction. And who knows what will happen down the pike. We change our jobs. We change our places of work. And that becomes part of our society, as this man writes. He talked about the fact that the divorce rate might decline. A question came up about that yesterday. And in one of these books, he talks about artificial blood and bloodless surgery, which will reduce health costs, and then he makes this interesting statement that children will be more spoiled. Well, that's talking about the culture in which I live, and that is the only book of the several that I've collected that uses the term American in the culture. All of the other books that I've looked at in terms of future trends talk about trends, and although they're written from one cultural perspective, they suggest that they're trends, what they're predicting is worldwide. For example, there's a man named Joe Capo. He is a man who is an expert in business trends. And he wrote a book for business people on how to prepare for this coming decade and the next century. Here's what he said. Businesses will be different, he said. Information, technology, and service industries will dominate the economy. In other words, we're not going to be producing materials anymore. They can be produced more cheaply in Taiwan and some of their parts of some of these Oriental cultures. And so therefore, what we are producing, the tangible goods, we're not going to be doing that so much in our more highly developed societies anymore, which has a lot of implications for labor, union costs, that kind of thing, and relationships and that sort of thing. At home, the union movement, which was high, very influential 15 years ago, is fading, and the numbers are going down significantly and steadily because information and technology and service dominate the economy. What do they say? 80% of all workers will be involved in the information industry by the time the century changes. The population will be older, he says. The middle class will be smaller. Interesting. Interest rates will be lower, we would hope so. And because we have become saturated with possessions, we'll be tired of collecting possessions, so there will be a demand for experiences. That's where the industries will grow. That's not only religious experiences, but the travel industry will boom. People who have the exercise industry will boom. The videotape industries will boom. Anything that gives people new and different and exciting experiences, those are industries that are going to grow, whereas just possessing things will not have the same attraction that it does now. Interesting predictions. More recently, a book came out by television evangelist Pat Robertson. He was also a one-time presidential candidate, as you probably know. He wrote a book that came out about 2 months ago with 10 trends that will impact us all by the year 2000. Now, I want to be very cautious in my comments about this, but here is his list of what he thinks is going to happen by the year 2000. Communism is going to collapse. Well, that's an interesting prediction. America will decline as a world leader. Everybody knows that. There will be an emerging power of Europe and of the East. Well, isn't that remarkable? You ought to be writing this down. There will be scandals in public education, which has already happened. There will be an assault on values in the family, which has already happened. There will be a renewed interest in the supernatural, which has already happened. Space-age technology will continue, and there will be a ravaging of our natural resources, and get this, there will be either worldwide peace and prosperity or worldwide war and collapse. Seems to me a good high school student could have written a book that's better than that. Nevertheless, the book is selling well. And I was in the dentist's office shortly before I came. And the dentist nurse was talking about this book and how insightful it is predicting the future. Well, we've had other people write books. Alvin Toffler wrote about a book several years ago in which he talked about future shock. He's come out with a new book called Power Shift. And he says the way the societies are organized in terms of power, that is going to shift. And political power is not going to be nearly as significant as it has been. He said the power is going to shift to people, and even people who have money and the ability to control violence. He said violence, money, and information are significant. But he said in the years that are coming, the people who are going to have the greatest power are the people who have the greatest access to information. And he didn't say this in his book, but think of the Gulf War. And certainly the coalition had stronger power, but they also had information. And they knocked out Saddam Hussein's information network. And because they knocked out his air force, they had planes that could go over and get information. They had satellites that could get information. And the side that won had the greatest amount of information. That's a simplistic explanation, I suspect. But information was very significant there. And Toffler's book, which is fat, overpriced and a little boring in places, nevertheless suggests we're going to see shifts in power, interesting shifts in power as we go through this next decade. Most of you are familiar, I suspect, with the name John Nesbitt, who wrote a book called Megatrends. He's come out with a new book called Megatrends 2000 and talks about such things as an economic boom worldwide. He says the Pacific Rim is going to be significant and make the most significant relevance in the world by the year 2000 and beyond. And that, of course, includes Australia and New Zealand. He said we are going to see that women are going to take significant roles in the society, much more than they've had. There's going to be a religious revival, he said, in the decade that is ahead. We're going to have what he calls the age of biology. And he makes some interesting comments about the emergence of how things are going to change economically. And one other thing that I wanted to mention was the triumph of the individual. We're going to see more and more emphasis on individuals and how individuals are developing in the years that are coming in the future. Interesting predictions and things that might be worth looking at. Of special interest to me, however, was a book that came up by a Christian researcher here again in the latter part of 1990. This was a guy named George Barna. He claims to be a researcher, and I assume he is, but his book doesn't say anything about his research data. But nevertheless, he's a Christian. And he's talking about how the church is going to change, or how the church has to change within the next 10 years if it's going to be alive and having an influence. If it's going to resist the upsurge of New Age influences and the effects that are coming from such things as Eastern mysticism and people who are dabbling in those kinds of things. Barna says that we are moving into a stage now where people in the 90s, and I'm quoting here, want flexibility, they want quality, so they're not going to go to church if there's no quality, they want control of their time, they want freedom from long-term commitments, which has a great relevance for volunteers in the church. They want practical demonstrations of philosophies that work. He said they are impatient with God talk and are inclined to dismiss any meaningless tradition, and they are skeptical about the relevance of old-time religion in a technological complex age. We've got to get with it, Barna says, who's an evangelical. If we don't get with it, he says, people are going to continue to leave the church in droves, and they're not going to come back because they haven't got the time for it, and they don't see the relevance of it. Barna's book was written for church leaders. It contains no information, as I mentioned, about the author's background, etc. But I thought that Barna's data has tremendous relevance for those of us who are in Christian counseling. For example, let me give you 7 or 8 concise statements that came out of Barna's book about the church that I think have relevance to counseling. For example, he says, and this is from his book, the church should quit moaning about the demise of relationships and publicly show by modeling, by example, that successful marriages do exist and are possible. Let's show the world that it's possible to have a marriage that exists, that is good, that is growing, and that is possible, instead of talking about how bad things are. The church of the year 2000, he said, will be technologically sophisticated. We've got to think about how we can keep up with the technology of the society in which we live. Time more, and this has some things to say about counseling, and I'll share some of that perhaps tonight. Because what do we do about the computer age of counseling? What's the relevance of that? The time more than ever, he said, will be of essence. Church leaders must become accessible to people or lose their influence and gain an image of aloofness. But by the same token, people who come to church are not going to have time for irrelevant programs, for boring programs, for what they perceive as meaningless God talk, for out-of-date tradition, and for programs that have nothing to do with where they are. And they're not going to volunteer and commit themselves to those things on long-term commitments unless they see some real value in this. I might add just in a parenthesis here. I was reading someplace the other day about missions. We talk about a lot of missionaries coming out of Australia, as I mentioned last night. We talk about evangelizing the world by the year 2000. You know who talks about that, don't you? People who are age 50 and above. And who is going to evangelize the world in the year 2000? Well, of course, the people who are in their 20s and 30s and 40s. But the people who are in their 20s and 30s and 40s, they're not part of the plan, part of the vision. And unless they get to be part of the vision, they're not going to be running out on somebody else's agenda. And it seems to me that if we're thinking of where the church is going and you want young people to be involved in what's going to happen in the future, they've got to own what's coming in the future. And we've got to get them more and more involved. Otherwise, you're going to say, the church is just for old people. We'll leave it. It seems to me this has got a lot of relevance for those of us who want to be practical in reaching people. We need to have practical applications of principles, Barna says, and see these applications in practice. Modeling acceptable behavior will be critical. Our society is largely anesthetized to religion and to God talk. In his little book, John Smith, about 2/3 of the way through, goes back to this example of this young man that he talked to on the street who told him to stuff it up his jumper. Smith says, if I could see that young guy again, you know what I'd say? I'd say, okay, Buster, you want to know what God's like? Well, I'll tell you, God's like Jesus. And wait a minute, forget your stained glass windows. He's not like that either. Let me tell you how he related to women, how he related to men, how he related to little kids, how he got along in his society. See, that's getting down to where this kid is. And that, I think, is what we need to do, according to Barna. As people's lives become more tense, he says, their time will become more valuable. And their skepticism about the influence and benefits of the church might become confirmed. It's going to be harder and harder to attract people. Interesting challenges that presents with us. People, he said, are going to be irresistibly drawn to organizations that radiate quality. That is true of baby boomers at home. They are now at the point they'd rather take the time and spend the money and get quality than to be buying a lot of cheap stuff, which probably isn't very good for Kmart. Churches that evoke a sense of quality will be more attractive than those that simply to continue to perform their usual routines, oblivious to standards. Interesting implications in terms of what we're doing in counseling. People in this decade, he says, will increasingly feel a sense of emptiness and loneliness. Leisure activities will be at the center of our lifestyles. But, and this is a quote, psychological counseling services will boom in the 90s as people struggle with self-worth and loneliness and difficulties in controlling their lives. Now, Barna's book is about the church, not about counseling. Then he says, each of us in leadership positions must be prepared for legal encounters. Quote, family and psychological counselors may be especially vulnerable during the 1990s as more people seek advice and counsel. But when they find the outcomes frustrating and unsatisfying, they will be inclined to sue, which has interesting implications. Are we advertising that we can counsel people, that we can give them something, and then we don't follow through with quality? And Barna's raising some issues that are disturbing to think about. He says this, and this is a concluding statement, if we want the Christian faith to remain a vibrant alternative to the world system, we must stop reacting and start anticipating. I wrote about this in the little Christian Counselor's newsletter that I turn out every month, and I said in there that if I was a pastor, I would want most of the members of my deacon board to read Barna's book. Because I think it's a book that has a lot of things to say, a lot of implications as to where we are going in the future. Now, what's this got to do with counseling? Maybe I'm trying to stretch it a little bit to make it fit counseling. Well, I would like to suggest to you that there are some trends that are taking place in the field of counseling. And I'm talking about professional counseling, pastoral counseling, lay counseling, which probably are the major three groups, but other kinds of counseling implications. I think these trends are things that are going to shape where we're going. Let me not give you a lecture on 8 or 9 trends in counseling and have you sit there trying to keep awake. I want to try and make this relevant. See if we can apply it to where we are. With each of these ones that I bring up, think of the situation where you work, where you could be working. How do these things relate to the kinds of things that are happening, not just in Australia, not just in Queensland or Brisbane, but in the community and the church where you happen to work, or in the agency where you work? These are only my predictions. They're not particularly, they're not any, given in any special order, and they're only the predictions of one man. But maybe they can give you some guidelines that I hope will be helpful. Number one, of the things we have to deal with in the future, I suggest, is the influence of New Age thinking. The New Age movement, as you know, is difficult to define. It's very elusive. But it has spawned all kinds of popular books, journals, seminars, and media presentations that features ghosts, astrology, crystals, channeling, and what somebody has called, quote, an eclectic collection of psychological and spiritual techniques rooted in Eastern mysticism, unquote. And we have all of these techniques that are emerging. Let us not be so naive as to assume that they're not here in Australia. And as I have read about the New Age movement in Australia, did a whole seminar on this a couple of years ago, passed that New Age bookstore the other night, and looked around, the New Age movement is very much alive and well in Australia. A lady by the name of, I think it's Morag Schwartz, Z-W-A-R-T-Z, I know how to spell her name even though it's spelled a little bit unusual, in an unusual way, wrote a book about the New Age movement in Australia and New Zealand. It's kind of a hard-hitting book, and I talked to this lady for a few minutes after a conference not long ago, but nevertheless she at least alerts us to what's happening in this part of the world. Now, the New Age movement, the people don't always believe the same thing. But they believe such things, for example, as the pantheism, all is God and all is good. They believe in that there is such a thing as individualism. Since each of us is God, we can decide what is right and wrong. So we have a relativism. What's right for you may not be what's right for me, but everybody, since everybody is God, everybody can make their own decisions about what's right and wrong, and we can build our morals and our lifestyles accordingly. There's a views on the importance of mysticism, astrology, chanting, as sometimes happens, in a repetitive kind of thing. Channeling, which used to be called spiritism or spiritualism, when you're trying to get a message coming from some force out there that kind of comes down and fills you with vibrancy and keeps you going. Very occult type, from my perspective. Now, the New Age movement is not just a collection of kooks, weirdos, and Hollywood actresses, although they're all there. It's interesting for me to think about how the New Age movement has penetrated business, education, government, some of the highest levels in our society. Some of the greatest advocates of the New Age movement are people who are well known, who are influential. Not long ago, Julie and I bought a small condominium, and I discovered, I don't even know if I told Julie about this, that the man who developed the whole condominium complex is a great sponsor of seminars in the town where this condominium is. Somebody said, not only is he a leader in the business, not only is he a leading contractor in the area, not only is he well known in the community, but he is one of the leaders of the New Age movement in the community, because all of the people who come in that he brings in for his seminars are pushing New Age type thinking. We've got to be aware of that. Now, if you want to read a book about this, I hate to keep recommending books that you can't find. But I think probably one of the best writers is a man by the name of Douglas Grotius. 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 Much easier to spell than Sin Yang Tan, but maybe hard to pronounce. Grotius. Now, Douglas Grotius writes a balanced perspective. He's a relatively young man. He's got three books. One is Understanding the New Age. One is Unmasking the New Age. And I think the most recent one is on Christ and the New Age. They're all published by University Press. So I suspect they would be available. Good overviews of what's happening. We've got to deal with this. What about New Age movement influences in your community? What about people who come along? A question came in on this. What about people who come along and say, I don't need your religion because I'm finding so much peace in my meditation. I'm having such a wonderful time with my crystals. Why would I need your Jesus? It seems to me that if we're concerned about evangelism and about reaching the communities for Christ, we cannot ignore that like it didn't exist. Paul, remember, when he got up on Mars Hill, he didn't stand up and say, let me present a gospel oblivious to your society. He said, I've been walking around. I've seen you have gods. I've seen you're a very religious people. In fact, I notice you've got an unknown God that you worship. Let me tell you about him. And while I'm telling you about him, let me recite some of your local Athenian poetry that I picked up. And he talked to the people in the marketplace. Paul knew what was going on around them, and that's why he had an influence there. But you'll notice that when Paul talked to those Athenians, some believed and some doubted and some criticized. And that's what's going to happen to us. But I think if we're concerned about counseling as pre-evangelism, if we're concerned about having an impact around us, we've got to be aware of the New Age movement, and it's hard to keep up. Russell Chandler, who wrote a book on the New Age, was told by somebody, he said, you either write a book about the New Age movement, or you keep up with the New Age movement. You can't do both. So that's very helpful, isn't it? It's hard to keep up with that, as if you didn't have enough stuff to read. Well, let me hit you with number two. I think we've got to be aware of the fact of the increasing influence of cults and Satanism in our societies. I raised this in Auckland last year, and I said I was concerned about the influence of cults in this part of the world. And a gracious lady put up her hand, she said, I appreciate your lectures and I appreciate what you said about cults, but she said, we're so grateful we don't have any cults in New Zealand. The reaction there was even more extreme than here. Because one by one, the people started popping up in the audience and telling us about cults in New Zealand. And about some of the tremendous groups that were having an influence and getting a foothold in that culture. Well, maybe she could say, all right, we have cults in New Zealand, but surely they don't have them in Australia. Well, we know that cults are very influential. We know about the Moonies. We know about some of those people who are more traditional cults. I mentioned the other night about this book that has just been published, it might even be a 1990 book, by David Milliken. This, my brothers and sisters, is a book that you can get. It's a book that is available because I walked into a bookstore the other day and I bought a copy for $16.95. It's published by the Australian Broadcasting Corporation and it's entitled Imperfect Company, Power and Control in an Australian Christian Cult. I was very interested to read, I haven't got it here, I was very interested to read a review of this book in the Sunday paper, wherever we were last Sunday. I read a review in the Sunday paper about this book, a review of the book, and the man was saying that this man, David Milliken, maybe he writes out of frustration because of what he sees going on around him. Maybe some of his own evangelical roots have been shaken. The man who developed this cult was involved with InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. And I mentioned it when I was in Perth, and a man came up and said, I know the man, he was an older man, said, I know the man who founded the cult. I was a good friend of his. We worked together with InterVarsity many years ago. And he said, I'm well familiar with what's happened. And he said, I'm deeply distressed at how this man has gone off the deep end and developed a small cult around him in Sydney. and David Milliken begins the book in this way. People are at their best and at their worst in religion. And I believe that both things can be true at the same time. Interesting implications. This has been, there's a whole article about it in the paper about 3 weeks ago, an excerpt from the book. It's an example, just one example, of what's happening among the rise of cults. Cults are especially attractive to young people, many of whom are disillusioned with the church. To this, we can attach the rise of Satanism. Incidentally, sometimes people are not disillusioned with the church. I have an interesting, I get something called the Cult Studies Journal. There's an interesting article in that journal about, a couple of years ago now, written by a missionary lady, and it was an article as to why MKs are especially susceptible to cults. And she gave a very interesting article to suggest that missionary kids grow up in other cultures in a close area where there's a strong leadership and a real desire to serve the Lord effectively, and they're surrounded by people who have left their families to serve the Lord. These kids come home to the culture, their home culture. They don't have that closeness. Sometimes their parents have gone back to the mission field. They're looking for a close group that they can be with, people who have cut off from their families, who have a strong spiritual leader. And many times these cults use language that sounds very much like the language we use, except it means something different. And there's a great concern, I think, around the world among Christians about the rise of cults and the rise of Satanism and some of the worship of Satan. Just before I left, I may have mentioned, I completed a book of case histories in Christian counseling. I found 9 people who wrote case histories. Some of those case histories were very interesting because I told them to write whatever case they wanted. And one lady wrote a case about a young man who had been involved in a cult, he'd been involved in a family as a child where the family was involved in a satanic worship. And he's hidden all these memories, but they keep bothering him, and he comes back and he has a memory now as he's been working with this counselor of being involved actually in murdering people as part of this cult. And this is stuff this is pretty heavy stuff. And I would think, okay, it's fine, that's a book, but Julie and I have a good friend, and he and his wife said to us not long ago, we have a couple of our kids who've had a terrible time with their spiritual lives. They seem to have almost been oppressed over the past several years, and now we suddenly discovered why. One of them remembered a house in our old neighborhood where they used to go in and spend time with the kids and with the parents, and apparently there was some kind of satanic ritual going on in there. That's not something that goes on in remote parts of the country. I would guess that goes on right here in Brisbane. I know it goes on not far from where we live because the police departments are very much concerned about it. And how are we going to deal with these things? I suggest we have to be informed. Now, don't let me send you on a guilt trip. We can't be informed about all these things. But maybe some among you have to have some special awareness of this difficult, difficult area and be concerned about that. Well, number 3, you're still with me. The increasing prevalence of people helper approaches. That's another thing that is evolving. First, we see the influence of New Age thinking. Secondly, the influence of cults and Satanism. Thirdly, this is radically different, there's an increasing arousal or interest in people, what we call people helping approaches. We've already talked about lay counseling. Not much has been said here about support groups. Alcoholics Anonymous is a support group. But there are literally thousands of these support groups around the world. Just about anybody who's got a problem can find a support group. And sometimes they're very good support groups. It's estimated at home that perhaps 500,000 people meet. There are 500,000 support groups meet every week. There was a cartoon in the paper last week, just a week before I came. It showed some lady. She said, on Monday, she says, I go to my Children of Alcoholics support group. On Tuesday, I go to the support group for victims of child abuse. On Thursday, I go to my support group of people whose marriages are breaking up. On Thursday, I go to some other support group, and she goes on Friday and Saturday, and then she says, Sunday, I go to my group of people who are victims of too many support groups. Well, maybe this is true. So we have these groups around. Let's not put them down. We need to work with them because that's where a lot of people are getting the help. And some churches are coming about now, and they're having Christian approaches to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they give it a little different terms. And groups of widow to widows, the kind of group I mentioned last night. That is part of a significant movement that is taking place. The whole idea of individuals who meet together to talk about their problems. Now, why is this important? Because in the first place, some people are never going to go to a professional counselor. Some people are never going to go to a pastoral counselor. Some people are never going to darken the door of a church. But they might go to a support group. And secondly, you need to remember that some people, those support groups, are the way you get them into the church. Somebody suggested last night that I should mention the Willow Creek Community Church that Julie and I attend, and Pastor and some of the members of that church are planning to come out here, I understand, next year to do a seminar, maybe one right here in Brisbane. They have some interesting groups. A group for unmarried pregnant women. A support group. Other people understand them. A group that I think it was called HEALS, HEALALS. That doesn't sound, I've got the numbers wrong. But anyhow, he helps us with addictive lifestyles. I forget what it is. He eliminates addictive lifestyles. And it's people who are addicted, not just addicted to eating. That's a different group. But a lot of these people are sexually addicted. They're addicted to pornography. They're addicted to certain kinds of deviant sexual behavior, and they don't know how to get out of this. And they come together in a support group. Do you think of the church having that kind of a support group? How about a support group for Christians who are homosexual and are struggling with this and want to change their behavior and can't do it? Is the church going to sponsor that? What about support for people who are going through a divorce? Or how about Recovery Incorporated? Have you heard of that group? It's a support group for former mental patients, probably like the person who had it in that question yesterday. We don't have those in the church, do we? Now, you may think, well, my church is small. I've only got 50 people. If we have 15 support groups, we don't have that many people in my church with that problem. And yet, maybe here's a place where denominations need to be sensitive, where groups of churches together need to think about this, where counselors could stimulate that sort of thing. Those support groups can be a marvelous adjunct to counseling. These are people-helping approaches. And of course, that includes all of what we've been saying thus far about lay counselors. Incidentally, I've not mentioned those people who are we might call them the other professionals, the teachers, the lawyers, the nurses, the people in the community who are not psychologists, the private practice physicians, not psychologists, but they are professionals who are doing a lot of significant work. And sometimes we need to be giving help to those people and working with those people because often they can serve a useful purpose. I read a study not long ago of a man who has developed a program for training beauticians in people-helping skills. Does that make sense to you? People go to have their hair done, and they sit there in this place, and they've got this beautician, and they're together for however long it takes. And you can sit and talk about your problems, and you go out into the night, or the day, and that kind of thing happens. So these beauticians were taking some skills. They tried something similar with bartenders. It didn't work too well because it's good. Apparently, the bartenders are very good counselors in the afternoon if there's not too many people in the bar. But if the bar gets crowded, it's hard to counsel. And if the counselee has too many drinks, it's also hard to counsel. So that doesn't work out too well. But here's the idea of the increasing influence of these people-helping approaches. My suggestion number four. I think we're going to see a greater emphasis on what have been known as populations at risk. Look around you. Who are the populations who are at risk? They're not Yavis people. And they may not be the people that you normally see in your church either sitting in front of you or surrounding you on a Sunday morning. These are the children of alcoholics who are more prone to become alcoholics than other people in the society. These are the people who are victims of abuse, who we know, statistically, are inclined to be abusive of their own children. They don't know how to deal with children any other way. These are the school dropouts, the teenage parents, the disabled, the caregivers who care for their chronic relatives. Have you ever thought about those people? Somebody develops Alzheimer's disease and has a wife. A man develops this and has a wife who looks after him. Or a wife develops this and the husband looks after him. And the husband is known as the caregiver. That caregiver is under tremendous amount of stress because he or she has to be with that person in need all the time. Somebody wrote a book called The 36-Hour Day. It talks about how to care for people who are Alzheimer's victims. Some mothers have the same experience when they got kids old. It's hard to handle a lot of kids, and it's difficult. These are people who have they're especially prone to stress. Also, people who experience a lot of stress at work. People who are middle-aged and lose a job, maybe because of the economy in which we're involved right now. There's a little town I read about someplace the other day, and the manager baker, he'd gone to the town several years ago to open his bakery shop, and he said, I'm now going to have to close my bakery shop because this town is drying up and people don't come to the bakery shop anymore. And here I am. He was 43, 45. He said, what do I do now? Where do I go? And it was an article on the victims of the current recession in Australia. In the newspaper this morning, somebody in the government says, we're on the other side of it. It's getting better. And we all hope that's right. But one of the columnists said, no, not yet. And there are people who are struggling here. How do you handle that? What happens if you are a person who wants to support your family and you can't? And you're pretty proud about that. And you don't want to be begging. You don't want to be getting in welfare lines and that kind of thing. These are people who are especially at risk. What about the people who've come here from other countries? What about the people who've come here from other states and are having trouble getting jobs and getting established? What about the Aboriginals? What about the Maori people? Maybe I haven't seen any of those around here. But what about what parts of Australia are these people? Where are they living? What kinds of struggles do they have? It's not easy. I know, at least I know that much. And I know this, we cannot, no one person can reach every group. I hate to hear talks like this because it sounds like you should go out and save the whole world. Well, go over the notes from last night or look at the tape on burnout before you do this because you can't do all of it. And one church can't do all of it. But these populations at risk are out there, and I think in terms of counseling, we've got to think of some creative ways to deal with those people. We talk about marriage counseling a lot, and that's great. We talk about dealing with kids, that's great. We talk about suicide, that's a crucially important problem. But let me suggest that there are whole groups of people out there that are untouched, especially by anybody in the church. That, I think, is exciting to see how some of the people who have displays in there are really trying to reach some of these specialized groups. Okay, these are the populations at risk. Everybody still with me? How about the changing family? We talked about that last night. But we know that the family is radically changing. Pick up any newspaper, any magazine, it seems, and you're bombarded with statistics about divorce rates and battered women and sex apart from marriage and abused children and the changing roles of women and non-traditional living arrangements such as multi-adult households, homosexual partnerships, and single-parent households. Family problems, I suggest, differ from one place to another, from one home to another, but they are there. A couple of years ago, Jim Dobson visited Australia and was taken by and asked by a group of pastors if he would extend some of his focus on the family ministry in Australia. And I know some of his newsletter materials get over here. But later on, two members of the team came back and visited Australia. And they wrote an article about Australia. Quite frankly, I didn't like the article because I thought it was too negative. But you might find it interesting because it appeared in this publication in May of 1990. The article was entitled Thunder from Down Under. And there was a picture of the Sydney Opera House. Anything that illustrates Australia has either a picture of the Sydney Opera House, Ayers Rock, or a kangaroo. Anyhow, he said, our recent journey confirmed Dr. Dobson's observations. Only 57% of the Australian population indicate any awareness of God. Only 3% attend church. I shared this with one other group, and they said that's a high estimate. And that might be a generous figure. Some say it's less than 1%. Australia's Governor General is an avowed atheist who refused to take his oath of office on a Bible. Ironically, this man is the official representative of the Church of England. A few years ago, the Prime Minister of Australia, also an atheist, refused to include prayer as part of the dedication program for the new Parliament House. He yielded when outraged Christians staged a public demonstration. Then he goes on to talk about the fact that perhaps the most alarming discovery occurred during a meeting with a group of marriage and family counselors. Hope none of you were there. These practitioners represented many of the Protestant denominations in Australia, but you wouldn't have known it by our conversation. We asked if any of Dr. Dobson's resources would be useful, and there was a unanimous no. Why, somebody said. Well, because he sees issues as black and white, was the answer. Perhaps, we suggested, it's because he uses Scripture as the basis for so much of his advice. Of course, one of the counselors jumped in. Therein lies the problem. How can a book written thousands of years ago have any relevance today? Okay, now that's a limited perspective. And I did challenge the people. I said, hey, you guys, I don't know where you were, but you have missed a lot of excitement going on in the Australian church. By the same token, they pointed out some of the difficulties and talked about a man who said to them, a counselor, who said, you know, we shouldn't encourage women and men to improve their marriages. Because after all, you're just stirring them up and that causes disruption in the home. Sometimes it's better to leave things as they are. Well, this is sad because even if it represents just a few people around us, this is no different than what we have at home. But the attitudes that we have around us on the family are distressing, and we all know that. And in my visits to Australia, I picked up several times that there's a deep concern about the family, especially among believers. How can we strengthen families? We've got to put an emphasis on strengthening the family in our people helper approaches. That's a trend. We've got to work on it. But another trend that we probably haven't thought much about yet is the changing age of our populations. Of course, we are all getting older. Somebody said aging is a very popular thing. Everybody's doing it. Well, maybe so, but somebody wrote a book not long ago called The Age Wave. And he said the older population is getting bigger and bigger. There's already tension in some parts of the world between older people and those who are younger. What's going to happen when those older people become the major voting bloc in the country? When they become, they're already a significant spending block in the country. And we're going to see more and more of these people may need counseling. How are you going to counsel them? You have to take a different approach to counseling the elderly. The newspaper last week gave a report from the Bureau of Immigration Research here in Australia, and it says that Australia has the highest rate of population growth in the Western world. Its growth of population is ahead of Canada, the United States, and Japan. But the growth, it said, will be dominated by those over 65. They now represent 11% of your population. By the year 1995, their numbers will be 2.2 million. And within 35 years, they will represent 21% of the Australian population. Now, these are older people. How are we going to reach those people? How do we reach them for Christ? How do we reach them in the church? How do we reach them in terms of counseling? Wonderful to see what we have in terms of our youth programs. A lot of churches will have programs for youth, and that's great because you got to get those kids in that early time. But do we have any influence or any concern about the older population? Who's ever heard there's hardly any ministers to the elderly in the congregation? There's some, but I think that's a change that's coming, and we need to be on the cutting edge and be aware of what's happening. Well, just let me mention a couple more and then I'll quit. We've got to think of the role of the church in people helping. I have been sensing this all the time that I've been here. I was interested, if I can go back just one last time, to John Smith. He's writing at one point about the role of the church. And he says this at one point. Few atheists appear to have arrived at their conclusions by purely intellectual progression. Most harbor an innate anger against the God that they so outspokenly deny. And the reason they're angry at God is because they don't understand God, he says. And they've got a wrong perception of God. I don't blame most Aussies for throwing God out. Most people have left God out because the God they saw expressed in the lives of others was not big enough to face all their questions and problems. He says, we've got to tell people that the God we worship is a different God. He ends the chapter in this way. At every turn, Jesus showed strength and goodness and love and forgiveness all the way through. If you had unforgiving parents, God is not like that. If you had a father who didn't look after you, God is not like this. We need to throw out all the gods which are based on the petty and tragic history of our culture and see the God that God is true and loving Father expressed in the person of Jesus Christ. It's a challenge we have, and a challenge that excites me because I see that you people in this room are concerned about that. Even concerned enough about these future things to come back on a hot afternoon and sit here and let some of these thoughts rummage through your mind. seems to me we've got to think about what we're going to do in the church. After I drew the circle on the board yesterday, remember, and divided it into six parts, somebody came up to me and said, there's a model for counseling. Gary, how do we apply that to counseling? How do we use our resources for training professionals, for training pastors better, for training lay people? How do we utilize our church resources for preventive counseling? How do we utilize our church resources for the public counseling, which is in the next category? How do we utilize our resources for dealing with some of those apologetic issues which are so crucial and so important for us to be dealing with in the church? Let's talk about how we can apply this and use this as a model here, not just in some other parts of Australia, right here even in Brisbane, right here even in the suburbs in which we are meeting. Well, I think that's significant. And we've got to think about how the church can relate to all of these people and all of these problems, because these are crucial issues that we have to face. Just a couple more. We need to build Christian counselor credibility. I started in my first talk here about mentioning David Hunt, and mentioning those people who are writing books against Christian counseling and especially against Christian psychology. And I mentioned during that first night that I thought that some of those people who are writing those books are not having a lot of impact in Australia yet. But they might come. And when they come, they may very well undercut much of what you're doing in counseling. They may throw a lot of people into confusion about what you're trying to do. And I think we have a responsibility for showing what we do, showing that we're doing it well, striving to do it better, and striving to do some research to show that what we're doing works. Now, I'm preaching to the converted, because you people have taken time to come here. We've mentioned that before. You have a concern for Christian counseling. Somebody said to me today, these people, somebody who is not even one of the organizers said to me today, you know, I'm fascinated to watch what's happening here. He said, Gary, these people are hungry for this kind of information. And that is exciting. I sit at home sometimes and I say to Julie, I'm going to cut out these trips overseas. They're draining. They take time. I go home exhausted. I spend a lot of time getting ready for them. And she says, yes, you always say that when you're home. And when you come back, you change your whole perspective. And we were talking about this last night. See? And she said, when I get involved with a group like this, I can't think of anything that I could be doing that's more exciting than being with people like you. Because you are cutting edge people. I really believe this. And I see a lot of exciting things happening here. I hope you won't cut me off, because I'd like to know what you're doing. And I suspect some of you are going to be the people who are on the lecture tour in another 10 years. And looking at what's happening here, and looking at what's happening in the places where you live. And some of you, are, I know, represent some other countries. Well, that's exciting to me. What are we going to do through tapes? What are we going to do through videotapes? What are we going to do through publications? What are we going to do through newsletters? There's a lot of potential. What are we going to do through books that are published here in Australia? I got a couple of them just at lunchtime today to see some of the things that are being dealt with here. How are you going to get over the tall poppy syndrome and be able to do some books and take some leading cutting-edge movements here in Australia? I think the church maybe is small. Maybe not very many people are there, but it seems to me that if we are sensitive, caring, compassionate people within the body of Christ, I think people are going to wake up and take notice, because sooner or later they're going to recognize that the society in which we live doesn't have the answers, and the pubs around us don't have the answers, and they don't tell us how to deal with our guilt and how to deal with our need for forgiveness and how to deal with our relationships that are breaking up at home and how to grapple with a declining economy, even if that's temporary, and how to deal with what's going to happen life after death. Well, what have I got? Maybe just one more. That's good, because I only got one more written down. I think we've got to be aware of ethics, integrity, accountability, and excellence. Four words that I try to use to guide what I do. I say try because I fall short on all four of them. But that's all right. I'm still working on this. Ethics. We've got to be concerned about good Christian ethics. Somebody raised a question. What about confidentiality? What if you go to a supervisor? Aren't you breaking confidentiality? Well, usually a counselor will let you talk to a supervisor, especially if it doesn't go beyond that. But you've got to be very careful. And wherever you are in the counseling role, are you keeping confidences? You start talking about people, that's a wonderful way to end your counseling ministry. And what about the whole issue of counseling ethics? What about the whole idea of keeping ourselves separate from our counselees so that we don't get too emotionally or in other ways involved with our counselees? Ethics become very important in the whole counseling field, the whole people-helping field, and that hits us wherever we are. And you may not have any formal training in counseling, but don't assume that you don't have any ethical responsibilities. As a Christian, you have those ethical responsibilities. What about integrity? Here's the idea of striving for the highest values possible. There's a whole little book at home on integrity written by the former president of World Vision, Ted Engstrom. He talks about integrity as, for example, saying what you're going to do and then doing it. Letting people know that you can be trusted, that you are somebody that can be relied on. That's integrity. Can we develop that kind of integrity? Maybe it's something very close to faithfulness. And then accountability. Somebody raised that question. It's not easy to deal with accountability. Sometimes you have to ask God, to whom can I be accountable? Somebody that I can kind of just talk to that will keep me on the straight and narrow. And I think one of the reasons that Jimmy Baker and Jimmy Swaggart got into trouble is because they didn't have anybody to be accountable to. Oh, they had boards. But the boards were of their own choosing, and the boards were all yes men and yes women. There's no accountability. You need people sometime to stand up and say, no, that's not right. You're not seeing things clearly. Now, many of us have it in our marriages, and we're grateful for it. Oh, we don't like it when it happens, but we're grateful for that. But sometimes we have this with another Christian brother and sister, with somebody else in our church, with somebody else where we work. We need that kind of people to keep us, help us to see things in the right perspective, because all of us have a narrow vision, and then excellence. That is one of the most overused words that we have at home. Everybody's striving for excellence. We don't even know how to define excellence. But I think we got the idea. We want to do the best job we can with the gifts we've got and with the opportunities that God has given to us. Well, what have I got? 9 suggestions? I would suggest they have implications in terms of our counseling. They have implications in terms of our training. They have implications in terms of our day-to-day activities. And maybe you would add something else to the list. This is just one guy's list. But I think maybe this can set some of the tone for where we might be going as people helpers in the years that are ahead. And for where you might be going as Australians in your work and as people helpers in the years ahead. Now, we're going to take a break in just a minute, and then we'll look at some of the questions that have come up. And I want to try and deal with a large number of questions as we are together. However, tonight, I'd like us to focus, as we're scheduled to do, on the whole question of those cultural issues, those social issues. And I can tell you now, I'm not going to come in and give you a 5-minute summary to each of those things on the list, because they're too complex for that. But those become significant as part of our people helping activities as well. Let's take a stretch, and then we'll take some questions.
Okay, let's see how far we can get.
Raised this challenge. I'm concerned about your comments about Scott Peck. He's a Catholic. In his book, What Return Can I Make?, a book that I'm not familiar with, he tries to respond to the question, God has done so much for me through the suffering and death of his son. What can I do for him? What return can I make? Peck writes that in that book about the grace of God, forgiveness, guilt, suffering, and sacrifice. He was outspoken about this concept of I'm okay, you're okay, because he said some of us, none of us is okay, and we're all sinners saved only by the grace of God. If the books appear in a New Age bookstore, it doesn't mean the author is New Age. They include everybody, unfortunately. Let me respond to the last part. You're absolutely right. And I talked a couple of nights ago about being careful not to imply guilt by association. Maybe there's an example of my doing something that I said we shouldn't do. Just because somebody's got a book in a bookstore where a New Age bookstore doesn't mean the book is New Age or the author is New Age. I appreciate what the person has said about this. And that's very interesting to me. I still maintain he's got some strong New Age elements in his book, A Different Drummer. And I think that is pretty clear. But I think, you know, maybe he's like all of us. Maybe he's grappling with some things and he's in the process of searching and that kind of thing. Some people I know wait until I get everything clear before they write their first book, and then they're too old to write it. Other people are willing to write while they're in the process of developing ideas, and maybe they change later as they go along. So I appreciate the person who has made this comment, because it helps us a little bit to get a clearer perspective on Scott Peck. Somebody else had a question right at the beginning, and I haven't gotten to it yet. It's a little bit of a complex question, but I think it's a very important one. Granted, we need to have a heavenly identity. This is a question about self-esteem and dying to yourself. Granted, we need to have a heavenly identity and a realistically appreciated picture of ourselves. However, self-esteem appears to have steamrolled into the church. I think that's probably true. We have a lot of seminars, and everybody's concerned about self-esteem. Jesus commanded us to love others as we love ourselves, but he also commanded us to die to self. How can we reconcile these two apparently contradicting aspects as counselors? Could it be that the words in Christ, that he is in us and we are in him, could that resolve the problem? What are the practical implications of this whole issue for our clients? Some of you, if you're really concerned about this, may want to get David Carlson's book in the series I edited. He's got a book on self-esteem, counseling and self-esteem. And David's done a marvelous job on this. And one of the things that I found most helpful, he says that to a large extent, we have difficulties because we don't define our terms carefully. We assume, for example, that if a person is going to deny oneself, that self-denial and self-condemnation are the same. They're not the same. And so we think that to deny ourselves, we've got to condemn ourselves. And I don't think that's the same thing. Or, for example, Dave Carlson says, we sometimes think that self-esteem is the same as self-promotion and pushing yourself. That's not true. You can have a good self-esteem and still be a very humble person. So maybe we've got to be very, very cautious about the terminology we use. And I think that happens, that permeates a lot of the debate here. Dave Carlson and Jay Adams had a debate on a local radio station at home on the whole issue of self-esteem. It was very interesting, the debate they had, because David said essentially what I said the other day. We can have a positive self-esteem because of what Christ has done in us and what he is doing in us, and we can maintain our humility in all of this. We can deny our own pushes to get ahead and to build ourselves. We can still deny ourselves and serve Christ effectively, but still have a positive self-esteem. And Jay Adams says, well, what are we here for? I don't have any problem with that. Having still written a whole book on condemning the whole idea of self-esteem. See, when we get our terminology correct, then I think there's not as much of the difficulties we might think. However, some of the books that are written about self-esteem, books that are written in the secular world, talk about the fact that we can have high self-esteem because of the great people we are. And they're built on a humanistic view of human nature, which talks about human goodness and that kind of thing. That, I think, has to be modified by Christians in accordance with the Scripture, some of the ways we were talking about the other night. Now, somebody asked if I have a suggested list for people to fill out before counseling. I think several of these have been published, and you can find them in different books. The Tan book that we've talked so much about has a list. The Bear and Stuckey book has a list. If you want a big long one, you can look, and there's a book on the book table on counseling people with sexual problems. That has a different kind of list. I think if you look into some of these books, you'll see that there are often forms that people can fill out just to give a little bit of background and that can help you to get information before you start talking to the person. Several people raise questions about the New Age movement. What dangers are there from the New Age movement and its influence on Christians who counsel and on Christians generally? And they give a couple of examples. For example, the reciting of a mantra. A mantra, as you know, is a word that you say over and over again to help you calm down. These mantras are assumed to be neutral words, but they're, for the most part, from my understanding, Hindu words. And a lot of what's going on in these kinds of situations is a Hindu form of worship. Some people came along at Harvard University and said, we will do some research, and instead of having a mantra, you just say the numbers, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. And they discovered people could calm down physiologically just as well by saying those numbers as they could by using this Hindu mantra. I'm very concerned about meditating, however, on a mantra or on a 1, 2, 1, 2, because the Scriptures tell us to meditate, but they tell us to meditate on the Word of God. And we read this in various parts of the Psalms especially, and I think we must be very careful not to be emptying our minds of things to the extent that therefore we let anything comes in that wants to pop in there. I think we focus our attention on the Word of God, and that becomes very important. So, this person says, well, what about intense marathon sessions? I wonder how much they really accomplish. Sometimes, and there's debate about this, sometimes they're designed to wear people down, but sometimes I think they become almost cruel, especially some of these what used to be EST, and now are the Forum Seminars, which incidentally are big in Australia, or at least they were a couple of years ago. You know, you can't leave the room for a number of hours, and if you leave the room, you're criticized. Do we get any place by knocking people down? I don't think we do. I think as Christians, I'm more concerned about encouraging people and building them up, realistically, rather than out there knocking them down. We're told in the Scriptures to build up one another and care for one another to encourage one another. No place do we read, condemn one another, knock down one another, clobber one another, in hopes that you'll grow. What about encouraging astral flight? This is a technique where you kind of imagine yourself, I think, getting out of your body and going someplace else. I'd watch out for those kinds of things. Some of you have read Richard Foster's book on celebration of discipline, an excellent book, and yet he encourages something which is awfully close to this. And he's been criticized for that one aspect of his book just because of that kind of thing. I'd be very cautious of some of these New Age approaches. Here's another one. Do you consider deep breathing and relaxation techniques, if used carefully, that is, not moving into suggested hypnotic techniques, can this be a useful technique? I have no problem with that. I think sometimes if you can learn to breathe more deeply and to slow down your pace, I think that can be helpful. That's just a physiological way to slow down the body so you can think more carefully. Learning to relax can be very helpful because a lot of us don't know how to relax. But I think that this person is concerned about extremes of this. Here again, we need balance. Do you think that guided meditation, that is gaining peace through imagery of Psalm 23, for example, can be useful for people? This gets awfully close, it seems to me, to some of the healing of memory stuff, you know. I'm not opposed to some of that, but I just be cautious. If you can recognize that Christ is with us all the time, that's true, that's good. But I think some of the people that Dave Honey is concerned about in his book said, you sort of assume you're going to somehow bring Christ up, you know, like the witch at Endor was supposed to be trying to do with Samuel. And that sort of thing you've got to be awfully careful about. And sometimes there's a thin line between some of these New Age approaches and between, there's a thin line between some of these approaches that are okay and things that are not okay. A thin line between what is not a cult and what is a cult. I generally work on the assumption that if in doubt, don't. Because I think that's probably a safe approach. The person also mentions a little bit about hypnosis here. That's a hot one. I know some people who are very much involved in use of hypnosis. In this book I edited, one man wrote a chapter on helping people through hypnosis, and I know this guy is a committed evangelical Christian. Other Christians have some real hesitations about hypnosis. And in my newsletter, I tackled it about 3 or 4 issues ago and suggested this very thing. I'm nervous enough about it. And Freud made the statement, Freud thought he didn't need it. He said, I think you can have accomplished without hypnosis most, if not all, of what you can accomplish with hypnosis. So I would not use it. I have not used it. And I'm skeptical of it. But if somebody is trained in the area, is a committed Christian, and we see this in their life and in their walk, and it seems to know what they're doing, okay, maybe it's okay there. I'm just cautious. Is that an evasive answer? At least it lets you know where I am, even if it's evasive. In secular counseling, there's a lot of emphasis on facing hurts from the past through talking, breathing techniques, etc. How much value is there in dealing with these hurts through facing them compared to inner healing and prayer in addition or the place of just talking? Okay. Many of us grow up wounded. Many of the approaches that we bring to adulthood, many of the problems we bring to adulthood come from our past. And for years we've known that it's good to go back and talk about those things. Now, I think sometimes we can overdo it. We spend so much time in the past, we forget about the present. And I'm not sure it's bad to be discussing healing of memories. Some of the books that are written on this, however, I have some discomforts about because I just don't think the authors are really aware of just how dangerous they are in dabbling in some of these things and stirring up a lot of problems that can create problems today, problems that maybe need to be dealt with, but you stir them up and then you don't know how to deal with them. If you are interested in the healing of memories, and please don't reject me because I haven't mentioned your favorite author, because there are a number of authors out there. I think the best writer in this area is David Seamans. S-E-A-M-A-N-D-S. I know David quite well.
David teaches at a Methodist seminary. He's been a pastor for a number of years. He's been teaching pastoral care and pastoral counseling. But he brings a very balanced perspective on this. He brings a very good biblical perspective on this. And I think I'm not suggesting that other people are not competent here, but I think David Siemens is perhaps the best one to follow. Pardon? Oh, the name of the book. Well, the book is by David Siemens. The Healing of Memories. Did I write the foreword to that book? The Healing of Memories and Healing Damaged Emotions. And Healing what? And Healing Grace. There we go. Healing Grace, Healing Damaged Emotions, and the Healing of Memories. One of those I wrote a foreword to, I think. I can't remember which one. Putting Away Childish Things. He's got more than one more, but that's another one. His newest one is out, and I forget the title of it. His book of the... Pardon? No, that's not the newest book. That one came out about 2 years ago. His newest one came out just before Christmas, and I talked to him a little bit about it. It's got a blue cover, and this one, he talks a lot about forgiveness. And I said to David, I think the best part of your book is your statement on forgiveness in there. It's excellent. It's very well done. You have used the word integrate. Clearly you differ from Jay Adams. How does he use the term integrate or integration? Jay Adams maintains that we can't integrate Christianity with psychology. And we shouldn't try to do it. And if we're trying to do it, we're trying to do the impossible. Some of you maybe have heard the story where a couple of years ago we presented Jay Adams with an award at the Congress on Christian Counseling in Atlanta. I was the man who presented the award to him. I didn't tell you the story, did I? I presented the award to him, and we gave him a beautiful desk set. We gave him a nice plaque. He was one of five people who got the awards, and each of the other four people got up and made some nice comments, and Jay Adams got up, and he tore us to shreds. I think he'd agree with that terminology. He said, you people in Christian counseling, especially you people who are psychologists and psychiatrists, you better get out of that field because you're not serving the Lord effectively if you're there. You're uninformed people. You're trying to integrate. You can't do that. And it was, I think insensitive would be an appropriate word, because we were all people who were having that perspective. And I wasn't sure what I was going to say because I was chairing the meeting. I presented the award. It's not my point to get up and challenge the man who just spoke. And he even quoted one of my books negatively. So I got up and I said, I appreciate Jay Adams' honesty. And I do. And I appreciate his courage, and I do. And he's made a contribution, I believe that. But I said, what is exciting about his response to that? I said, did you hear it? Jay Adams is finally reading Gary Collins' books. And that's all I said. But even Jay laughed. Well, but he doesn't believe in integration, doesn't think it could be done. You suggest a given problem taken to a psychologist would be handled in one way by the secular psychologist and another way by the Christian psychologist. Purely each has results. So how do you evaluate the respective results and outcome? Should there be a clear contrast? Good question. Yes, they both have results. We've studied, and I'm not going to say that the secular counselor is not being effective, because many of them are being effective. I believe that. And some of the problems they deal with, they can be as effective as a Christian counselor can be. Especially problems like dealing with skills and study skills and learning interpersonal relations and those kinds of things. Of course, the secular counselors can be very helpful on those kinds of things. And it's very difficult to evaluate compare their results as contrasted to the Christian counselor's results. Everett Worthington, who wrote a great basic article several years ago on religious counseling, went through every journal he could find on religious counseling for the last 10 years and synthesized the whole thing together in a massive article. He said, when you start looking at the research that has been done, you won't like this, there's no difference between what we find out in the results of Christian counselors and secular counselors, which is interesting. However, I think the Christian counselor can deal with some things that the secular counselor really doesn't understand. And can't, because the natural man understandeth not the things of the Spirit, because they're foolishness unto him. And sometimes we are going to be dealing with things the Christian counselor does not, the secular counselor does not know how to touch. But certainly, many counselors, Christian and secular, can be useful and can come up with some useful conclusions. When people appear and claim to be filled by what they've found in Eastern and New Age religions, how can you dialogue with them, especially when they're not interested in the truth, such as Christianity? Good question. And here again, with difficulty. And maybe you can't get very far. Sometimes you can, because when people argue from their own experience, it's very difficult to deal with those people. And when you find somebody who comes along and say, don't confuse me with facts, I've got my own experience. Incidentally, that applies to us too. And you come to somebody and say, well, don't confuse me, don't ask me questions about Christianity. I know Jesus lives and he's in me, and therefore I'm not interested in discussing things factually. See, I think we have to have some support for what we're doing. We have to have some understanding of what we believe and why. Our apologetics is as important as our experience. When we argue from experience, then it's one person's experience against another. And that experience is important. I don't deny that. But I think then we need to look and say, well, let's look at some of the things you believe in as a New Age person. What is the basis for what you believe? When I wrote a book several years ago called The Rebuilding of Psychology, I said, let's take the example of the fact that God exists. What's the basis for that? We can't prove it to 100%. But look at the evidence in favor of God's existence versus the evidence in opposition to God's existence. And I think you'll begin to see the evidence in favor of God's existence is greater, even though we can't prove it 100%. So I think there's a place for experience, but there's a place, if you're going to deal with somebody on New Age issues, you need to understand what New Age people think. You need to learn some of their language. You need to read books by Grotius and others so you can deal with them. And I think then you can start talking on a more intellectual basis. But if you're just going on their experiences, you're not going to get very far. Now, with some of these people, they don't want to debate the issue. Their mind is already made up. And maybe we're that way too sometimes. But it's very difficult then. And you maybe have to say, well, I can't get any further with you. I'll continue to pray for you, which incidentally will make a great deal of influence. And maybe at some later time you're able to come back and talk to that person. Well, how am I doing? I've got about 6 done, right? 40-something to go. Yeah, all right. In this morning's diagram, I don't know what morning we wrote this, so it's going to be interesting to see what morning's diagram. You stated that the aim to get the person being helped is to a stage where they no longer require counseling, but a friendly relationship can continue. How do you extract yourself from a situation where the person will not or cannot, due to a psychiatric disorder, listen to advice, and is totally dependent on your visits, especially when you feel obligated to continue, knowing that it's futile? This is why it's much easier to be in some field other than counseling and people helping. Because there are some people who are going to hang on forever. In the church, I think there are pastors. I don't know about the churches here, but you have some people who are leeches. You don't have to nod your head. They're there all the time. And you try to work with them and they never seem to get better. They are basically dependent people. And the more, as hard as you work on them, they still are basically dependent people. Now, what do you do? Well, you can't kick them out. You might suggest they try another church down the street. But if you do that, the guy down the street will send you his leech back to you. So you got to be careful on that. Incidentally, some of these people do a lot of that church hopping, too, I've noticed. After they get tired of you, they go on to the next congregation, and you breathe a sigh of relief, but there's always some around. Now, I think all you can do is put limits on these people. You can limit, you can say, look, please don't call me at this time, or if they call, say, boy, I appreciate your call, I know it's difficult, let's talk about it tomorrow morning. And that can be it sounds better to say that here than to do it. Sometimes you need to put some limits. Sometimes you maybe have to take your phone off the hook. Sometimes you just have to somehow you've got to limit them, because otherwise they will completely dominate you and take your time. Maybe you need somebody else to help limit you. Because sometimes I can't always limit myself, so I have other people run interference for me. That's a good question with a hard issue to deal with. When are a couple considered to be married? Two people living in de facto come to church and are generally considered to be married to the awarenesses of people, and you treat them as such, and then it's found out that they're not legally married. The church may tend to reject them. This is sad. How do we make members of the congregation aware of this? I consider the union to be improper before legalization, as it is a state requirement and the church tradition. Now, this is a good question, because some people say, well, we're married, we live together, we are engaged in sex together, we share our budgets together and all that. We're married, we just haven't gone through the formalization of a ceremony. And yet, legally, you should do that. But they can make a very good case, and they can say, well, look in the Old Testament. Did they go through a ceremony in the Old Testament? Well, yes, that's true. Maybe they didn't. But I think here again, they were legally before God. Before God's eyes, they were people who were married. Now, I would suspect if you had a couple like that in your church, I would encourage them and say, look, legal before God, until you've come to that kind of time or that ceremony, it seems to me, and before the law, it seems to me that you are not legally married. But if everybody thinks you're married, maybe it's not the place to make a big issue out of it and say, this, we want you to tell you that this man who's been in our church, he and his wife have been in our church for the last 25 years, they've been living in sin all this time, and we want you to know about that. I'm not sure that needs to be said. I think I would be more inclined to have a quiet wedding. I don't know if I might get in trouble for that kind of suggestion, but I wonder if you need to make a big issue of this kind of thing. But I think I would encourage these people. Basically, if you look in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, talks about the fact that when a couple engages, and the end of chapter 6, I think, when a couple engages into sexual relationships, in God's eyes, the two have become one. Well, that creates all kinds of havoc in our society when there is so much open sexual behavior and so much confusion. I am convinced that when a couple has that legal commitment, there's a change in their way of thinking. There's a change in their way of viewing themselves, and a change in the way of viewing their relationship. And I suspect at that point, they're going to feel better about it. And it's a difficult question about a specific problem, but I think depending on where they are, I'd encourage them to get married. How public you make it would have to depend on the situation. You mentioned Ephesians 5:21, mutual submission. Would you expand on this and explain how you understand that to work in family life? Sometimes I get concerned about the fact that husbands come along and say to their wives, okay, your job is to submit to me, so I'm going to sort of crack the whip and be the boss. I don't think that's what the scriptures are talking about. In fact, when it talks about wives submitting to their husbands, it says, as Christ loved the church and gave himself for the church, that's your job as a husband. You've got to be loving and you've got to be giving. Before Julie and I got married, we talked about this. And Julie said, I don't have any problem submitting my husband if my husband is loving, seeks to be loving like Christ loved the church, and is in a giving relationship. Now, it seems to me that in the both sides, if we are both loving and caring for the spouse, and both willing to give to the spouse, and both willing to be concerned about the spouse, and to listen to what the spouse has to say, especially when the spouse challenges us, then I think that's a mutual submission. I should probably let Julie speak for herself, but she would probably say that if we reached an impasse in our marriage and it was her opinion against mine, she'd say, okay, Gary, I'll let you have the final say. But I don't know that we've ever got to that point in almost 27 years of marriage, because if we had a difference of opinion, we'll work it through and talk it through and wait until we both pretty much agree on the way that we ought to go. And I think that shows a mutual respect for one another. And that I think is better than one person trying to crack the whip. I especially dislike it when one person uses that to kind of browbeat the other person and maintain some kind of a superiority, which is a smug superiority and an unkind and unfair superiority. Dr. Stephen Alford says that the more we give our people from the pulpit, the less we will need to counsel them in the pews. In this context, would you agree or disagree with the role of expository preaching as helping to eliminate many of the counseling situations and problems which tend to stifle the growth of many Christians? I am convinced that expository preaching, seems to me it's not done very often much anymore, but I'm convinced that it can be very helpful and very useful and very relevant to people. I agree with that. I don't know that I agree with his statement from Dr. Alford, however. And he, of course, is what? He's one of the princes of the preachers. Because I think sometimes if you're really preaching about things that hit people, that's going to stir them up, and they want to come and talk about it. Secondly, I think his statement assumes that if you give them instruction, that they can therefore accept the instruction, imply it, and solve their own problems. A lot of times people are too disturbed, too distressed, too churned up to be able to do that. and they can't even hear what you're saying, even if it's stated well, with the beautiful ways that Stephen Olfer states it. And they can't always get past some of their own obstacles and their own frustrations and their own misunderstandings. We also remember that people sometimes misunderstand what we say in a public meeting. Have you ever had that happen? We had a conference several years ago. It was at Schuller's Church, of all places, before the Crystal Cathedral was built. I was only invited to go there once. I don't know why they didn't ask me back. Anyhow, yes, I think I do know why they didn't ask me back. I said something about positive image at one point, and I maybe didn't quite use the right term. But anyhow, I was talking about it was a conference on singleness. It was, we had a good conference. Good people, good time there. Good time. And I was talking about some of the stresses of the single lifestyle. And along the way, I just happened to mention sex. As part of my whole talk, it was a minor part of the talk. But it was a large group there. There were 1,500 people at the conference, as I recall. And the next morning, we were having breakfast in the hotel. And a lady was, you know, everybody in the hotel was from the conference because we'd used up all the hotels all around the area. And I was having breakfast with somebody, and a lady came up and she said, "Hey, did any of you guys hear that speaker last night?" She said, "I was sitting at the back. I couldn't see him very well, but I thought, thank the Lord for that. But did any of you hear him?" I said, "Yeah, I heard him." She says, "Wasn't he awful?" I said, "Well, I've heard worse, but I didn't think he was that bad. Well, what did he say?" And she said, "Well, that part about saying that if you're single, it's okay to have sex with anybody that you want." I said, "Oh, I don't think he said that." Well, she said, "No, I know he said that." And she said, I'm an Episcopalian, and the rector of my church would not go along with that, and I'm leaving the conference today, and I'm going home." And I said, "Wait a minute. Wait, why don't you talk to the organizers of the conference? Talk to somebody else. See if he really said that last night, because I'm sure he didn't say that." Whereupon, I asked the next 15 people that I saw, "What did I say last night?" But she had twisted something. Maybe she'd misheard something. You see, and that is very easy for any of us to do, but it is especially easy to do if you're struggling with an issue or concerned about a problem, and somebody may give a good, concise statement about it, and you miss something, or you twist something, or you get something wrong. So therefore, in the preaching, it may be you need clarification after that. In no way, however, do I put down preaching, because I think that's the public people helping that we talked about. And that, I think, is crucial. And that's important that we have that, we do that public people helping. Considering the potential of one who has suffered a nervous breakdown, is it possible or even acceptable that they could get into the counselor's chair? Realizing, of course, that they need to be able to ward off any pressures that can be brought upon a counselor. And this person is saying, okay, if you've had problems yourself, should you ever become a counselor? I think if you've had problems yourself, you've worked them through, you are functioning fine now, then I think, why not become a counselor? Sometimes you can have a greater empathy and a greater understanding, but you also have a greater awareness of the dangers. And if you've got somebody that you can continue to talk to, somebody who can help you when you tend to get burned out, to me, I can see no reason why we can't go in that direction. If we say that a person who's had problems should not become a counselor, and there are some dangers here, so you need to watch that out. Be careful for that. But if we set up stipulations that you can only counsel when you haven't had any problems, then we're not going to have any counselors left, are we? So I think here's a place where you need to be alert, and this person seems to be alert, that pressures can be intense, I can get into difficulties again. Okay, with that awareness, then I think you can be free to go ahead and do some counseling, but I just be careful. What are your views on two people counseling together, such as a husband and wife team? We have found that in years gone by, we always referred people who came to us to professionals, and in every case, it never worked. So we have bitten the bullet and do our best with them now, but we do it as a team. Well, I think you recognize that a lot of counseling now is done as teams. See, when I drew that little picture on the board this morning of the counselor and the counselee, well, I assumed it was one counselor and one counselee. But sometimes it's very helpful for a couple to work together. Now, there's a danger in couples working together. And most people that I know who do couple therapy have acknowledged that danger. Because sometimes the problems that the person is bringing up, they trigger problems in your own marriage. So therefore, it's very important that you have a good relationship, and it's probably very important that you are able to talk about yourself with somebody else. Because that can be a threat to your marriage if you're dealing with other people's problems along the way. Also, but if you're dealing with a couple, that can be very helpful to the couple, because suppose you are a male counselor and a couple comes in, it's easy for the wife to feel ganged up on. Or if you are a female couple, If you are a female counselor and a couple comes in, see, it's easy for the man to feel I'm being left out. So sometimes if you have a husband or wife, counseling a husband or wife, that can be helpful. As you know, there's a lot of emphasis now on what we call systems counseling. It suggests that problems don't appear alone. Problems appear in a system. And if you take one person out of that family and counsel that person, and then send that person back into the family, all of those influences in the past will take away what you've done in counseling. So if you can get the husband and wife out together, that's better. Sometimes you bring the whole family out, and that can be better. And if you've got a kid who's a delinquent, it's okay to work with the kid, but if you can work with his mother and father and other members of the family, that can help too. And you discover when you see the family, now I know why the kid's delinquent. And we're dealing with the wrong person here. And the real person ought to be somebody else. And sometimes you'll have a person come in who's struggling, I can't get along with my husband. When you see the husband, you understand why. And sometimes the client in front of you is not the person who's the real source of the problem. So if you can bring more people in sometimes, it's hard, but it can be done. And very often that's going to work better when you have a husband and wife working together. There are dangers, but I can see no problem with it. I think it can be useful.